Welcome to It's More Than That.
And then he took my husband's driver's license and he called the border patrol on us. He got suspicious because of his last name. His last name is Muhammad. So at that time, we were just afraid, just don't shoot us. You know?
Right, right. It's More Than That is a podcast by the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm Paula Peterson. Often we don't understand the full story of someone's reality. Join me as we explore the complexities of the human experience. This week on the show, Arshia Khan. Well, I want to welcome you, Dr. Arshia Khan, Associate Professor of Computer Science, and congratulations on your recent tenure and promotion.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much. And I'm very, very happy to be here. I'm honored to be invited by you. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming into the studio this morning. So, as you know, this is the Campus Climate Podcast, inspired by our current campaign called It's More Than That.
Mm-hmm.
So we are just inviting various folks from our campus community to join us and have a more in-depth conversation about who you are, the work that you do, our campus climate, its impacts on you, both negative and positive. And I know you have been active with us working on campus climate on campus. So,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah. So we like to start with a little bit about you as a person and where is home for you and how did you end up at UMD?
Well, I've lived in the U.S. longer than I've lived anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say U.S. is home,
yeah.
Duluth, Minnesota. Duluth is the place I've lived longest.
Okay. How long is that?
18 and a half years.
Oh, yep.
Yeah, that's a long time.
Your children were raised in Duluth.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. The youngest was born in Duluth. The other two were born in New York.
Okay.
So.
Did you go to college in New York then? Or?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
Hofstra University there.
Okay. All right. So where were you born and raised, Arshia?
I was born in Hyderabad, India.
Okay. Okay. Is that where your family is then? Or?
Most of my family is in the U.S.
Yeah.
My mom lives with me and my brothers. My dad passed away a month before he turned 60.
Mm-hmm.
But we take care of our mom and she lives, she travels between the three of us.
Oh.
I have two siblings. So.
Okay. That works great, I would imagine.
Yeah, it's really nice. We fight over her. And
wow.
Yeah. So sweet. We each have a room for her in our house, just for her. So she can come and be comfortable, enjoy the grandkids.
Yeah. Is there a certain season that she chooses to come to Duluth?
Of course, the summer.
Wise.
Yeah.
Okay.
So come October, she flies out.
Yeah.
She won't stay here beyond October.
Yeah. So how did you end up in Duluth and at UMD? I know you've had a few roles and in the community.
Right. So after finishing graduate school in New York, my husband was doing his residency there. And then he got and then he did his fellowship in New York as well. That's where the two kids were born. And then we moved to Pittsburgh, where he was doing his super specialization, hepatology at University of Pittsburgh. And then he had to work in an area where no American would want to work, underserved area, basically.
Sure. Yeah.
Because we came on a visa called J-1, J-1, okay. J-2. So it has a requirement that you have to leave the country for a couple of years and then you can re-enter, but then you have to reapply and stuff like that.
Okay.
So we couldn't just take the kids and pack and leave. Where would we go, you know?
Right, right.
So we went through the waiver process. So he started working in Haywood, Wisconsin. So
wow.
That's where we first came. But
okay.
I couldn't find a job over there, so we moved to Duluth. So I was working in Duluth, and he still works in Haywood, Wisconsin.
Oh, he does.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He likes it.
Yeah. Oh, well, good. Good, good. So does he drive back and forth?
Yeah, he does.
Every day?
No, he works 12-hour shifts here. He's a ER physician.
Okay.
So he works 12-hour shifts. So he leaves and he'll go for 12 hours. And if he's got consecutive days, then he stays in Haywood.
Okay.
Otherwise, like this time, he's got 3 days off, so he's home. But this entire weekend, he's working.
Okay.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So.
Okay. So he has a place to sleep then when he's there.
They give him a place to sleep.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I did not realize that. Yeah. Okay. So you end up doing some solo parenting at times.
A lot. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And through that 10-year process, I know that's quite the process, and we had some conversations during that. So I know that's not for the faint of heart.
Yeah, it's tough. And this was my second tenure, because I was tenured at St. Scholastica as well.
That's right.
Yeah, so I've been through the tenure twice. Actually, I got a third tenure because I got a fully tenured position at another university. And
okay. So that's not a typical story.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. So after I got my tenure at CSS, I came to UMD on a term position. Mm-hmm. And because I was tenured at CSS, I was the department head for several departments there. And then I was also the interim dean for a while.
Wow.
I came here and the term position felt like somebody dropped me from the sky.
You know, very different climate.
Very different climate. And I could not do any research. It was pretty heavy teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So I went and looked for another job. Mm-hmm. That was my first year here. And I got a fully tenured offer. And so I came back to UMD and I said, you know, can you do something about this? And otherwise, I have a fully tenured job and I would leave.
Mm-hmm.
And so Josh Hamilton was the dean at that time, and mm-hmm. he said, give me 24 hours.
Wow.
And within 24 hours, I had an offer.
Wow. So that you could stay in Duluth.
I could stay in Duluth.
Yeah.
Which was nice.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And then we sort of negotiated that, you know, since I already had a tenure, the tenure clock would be shorter. So mm-hmm. I had a 3-year tenure clock.
Okay. And already enough scholarship to earn you tenure.
Right.
So, yeah.
Right.
So that's.
Yeah. And then I had to, like, the faculty here didn't know me.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sort of work very hard to gain their trust and confidence, mm-hmm. you know.
And to prove yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about your research and your scholarship. And I've seen videos of it. I know it's very innovative.
Yeah. So my background is computer engineering.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I sort of keep pulling myself towards hardware stuff, you know, mm-hmm. somehow. So I love working with robots and wearable sensors. And so I started off, my first project was working with the St. Luke's Hospital with Dr. Mary Boylan there.
Mm-hmm.
We were working on recovery after open heart surgery, using robotics in recovery after open heart surgery. And then I found out about vascular dementia. You know, because apparently anybody who's had any sort of cardiac event has 25% chance of developing vascular dementia.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that sort of intrigued me. And so I started looking into dementia. And now I would say 80% of my work is in dementia. So we try to approach it in from two different perspectives. One is, if we can develop a predictive model, watching and monitoring people over a period of time and seeing their behavior and learning from their behavior. And so that's one avenue. And mm-hmm. the other avenue is where we are looking at using robotics. So people who've already developed dementia, can we use robotics to maintain their quality of life?
Mm-hmm.
So those are the two perspectives.
Sure. So I think that's the video I saw. That's fascinating. So, campus climate. What you've worked with us some, I know.
Right.
Even though you were tenure track. I think even when you were a term faculty, you were engaged with the community and campus climate. And just wondering if you would share any from your perspective.
Sure. So I was the chair of the Multicultural Diversity Committee for two terms. And it's been a wonderful experience, you know, to see the enthusiasm, you know, from the university to help support these kind of things. So it's been a good experience. I really enjoy working in that area. And so,
You have some passion.
I am very passionate because growing up, you know, I went to a Catholic school throughout my schooling.
Okay.
So my mom used to always tell me, you know, well, there's no difference between Islam and Christianity. The only little difference is that they say Jesus is the God, and we say Jesus is, a prophet.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying son of God, we say a prophet. That's the only difference. So I used to go to the church every day.
Mm.
You know, I remember before my exam, I used to run to the church, get the father's blessings, you know, the father in the Catholic church,
wow,
you know.
I did not know that.
And if there was a day when my father got a little late and dropping me off to school and I wouldn't be able to get father's blessings, I used to be upset with him, saying, Daddy, I'm not going to be able to get father's blessings and I'm going to mess up my exam and it's going to be because of you.
Wow.
Yeah. So,
maybe for context, the listening audience, so you are Muslim?
Yes, I am a Muslim, practicing Muslim, yes.
And very involved in the Islamic center in Duluth.
Yes, I'm on the board of the ICTP, Islamic Center of Twin Ports as well.
So how do you end up going to a Catholic school?
Because the Catholic schools are the best schools you can find, the discipline. Actually, when I was looking for a school for my son here, the first school I sent him to was a Catholic school in Pittsburgh. Okay. He was only two at that time, but I put him in a Catholic school. So
that is not what I would have expected, Arshia. I feel like I know you, but I did not know that.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So that's okay.
Yeah.
And you didn't feel any bias or, I mean,
no,
your children don't have to.
I don't know what my 2-year-old experienced at that time.
Yeah.
That I cannot tell.
Yeah.
But I had the feeling that, you know, you get the best education at Catholic schools because I went to a Catholic school, Rosary Convent High School in India.
Mm-hmm.
And even for, like, we have a 10+2 system in India.
Okay.
So even for those 2 years, I went to a St. Anne's Catholic school. University, before I started my engineering.
Yeah.
So,
You know, a connection that I'm just making now is, one of our workshops on religious tolerance in the OED certificate program. There's some research that the director, the system-wide director, was citing that Muslim students. It was interesting because this idea that going to a Catholic school or a religious affiliated school was actually more comfortable because even though it's not the same religion, there's this understanding that that you can talk about it, that there isn't the separation of church and state, which is.
Exactly, because they're already getting that foundation of faith, you know.
Right.
Then it's just a matter of telling the kids, well, you know, this is the slight difference. Because ultimately, the goal is the same, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We all believe in God so that we can live a good life here, right?
Yeah.
Isn't that the main purpose? So there is some guiding principle around our lives.
Mm-hmm.
That is what, at least I believe, faith is.
Sure.
And so that if there is some guiding principle already informed to the kids, then we can tell them the details of our faith.
Yeah.
So there's little work there. Otherwise, we have to build that foundation and then teach them about our faith.
So. Okay. So that makes sense in a way I didn't even realize it made sense. Thank you. Yeah. So how is that for you then as a faculty member in a public institution that does have that separation of church and state? And
I don't really mind that
mm-hmm.
because in my class, I never say that I'm a Muslim, because I'm afraid of how the students might interpret that. And, you know, especially when I was going up for tenure, you know, I didn't want that to impact my student evaluations. So I was very mindful of that. And so in from that perspective, I don't mind the separation.
Right. Yeah. You know, in terms of
I appreciate the separation.
Right. Yeah. The bias. So have you experienced, if you don't mind me asking, and you're comfortable sharing some bias?
Sure. So when I was at CSS, I had a student who was working with me. He worked with me for 2 years and was doing research and was a fantastic student and, you know, was very respectful, really nice. And I think it was during Ramadan he found out that I was a Muslim, and then he never spoke to me or was respectful, never said hi after that, just vanished.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. So an impact not only on you, but on him.
Yeah. So that's when I decided, okay, I'm never going to tell anybody, any of my students, that I'm a Muslim.
So. Yeah. So you didn't or don't at UMD either?
No, I actually in my lab was just at the start of the Ramadan, I told them that I'm a Muslim, I'm fasting this month. And and because they all go out for lunch together.
Yeah.
And I have about 9 students working in the lab every day now. They'll be working throughout the summer. So so I told them that, you know, you guys can go for some for your lunch, but after Ramadan, I'll join you guys.
Okay.
So I was comfortable telling them because I thought, well, I'm tenured now, and because of all the media support that I've gotten from UMD, which I'm very appreciative of, you know, there are a lot of students who are interested in doing work with me. So I'm hoping they will look past that.
It's, I wish it wasn't something they needed to look past, you know, just even that lens of looking past it. Tells that it's that there's bias that you experience and worry about experiencing.
So we'll see. This is an experiment.
To be out.
To be out of my closet. Muslim closet.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, you're so public in the community that it's hard for me to imagine that someone would not know that you're a Muslim. And yet our students might not be tuned into the community in a way.
Yeah, I don't think our students, especially computer science students, they're sort of tuned in into the monitors, you know, into the computers, into the devices.
Yeah, okay. But sometimes you show up on my device.
Oh, I do?
Yes, okay. Yes, on the news. And
Yeah. So, yeah, but I don't think they've made the connection as yet.
Sure. Okay.
And plus, I don't look like a Muslim, you see. I don't dress like a typical, a stereotypical Muslim that the media portrays.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. You can pass as we're using similar language here as closets and passing.
Exactly,
and, interesting, sure.
Yeah.
So you are, I wanted to say celebrating, that's probably not the right word. You're in Ramadan now.
Yeah.
And so can you talk a little bit about that in terms of your fasting? Because I'm sure it's more than that.
Yeah. It's not just about food and drink.
Yeah.
The idea is that, you know, we all need discipline in our lives. And Islam is a lot about discipline, you know, like praying 5 times a day. God doesn't need our prayers, you know. It's to discipline us. So 5 times a day, if you know that you're going to be standing in front of God and praying, you will behave right, you know, like we'll tend to behave in between those prayers, you know. So that's the idea. So it's like reminding us 5 times a day that you have to be a good human being. That's bottom line, you know. So that sort of extends into that principle. We take it into Ramadan. And during Ramadan, we fast from dawn to dusk. So it's not sunrise to sunset. It's dawn to dusk.
Okay.
So dawn, as of this morning, was 3:47 in the morning. And dusk is 8:38 tonight. So we cannot eat or drink during that time. Even if I look at you with a frown on my face, my fast would break. Hmm. So we are supposed to be at the best behavior we possibly can under extreme conditions.
Right.
So it's practicing for one whole month, and God was hoping that it would rub off on the rest of the 11 months.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And of course, pregnant women, nursing mothers, elderly, who and anybody who needs to be on medication should not be fasting. Mm-hmm. And children cannot be fasting.
Oh, okay. I didn't. So children, at what age then do they?
Above 18.
Above 18.
Yeah, okay. Once they're adults,
okay,
they're required to fast.
Okay. So impacts, I think of, you know, you being in your lab every day and all day, and, you know, how do you need to kind of recalibrate your life around the impacts of fasting?
So the first couple of days are a little tough because it's not that you're hungry. It's just that you're so used to seeing food and grabbing and putting it in the mouth, you know.
Sure.
That self-control is what we develop. Mm. That, you know, okay, I cannot eat, I cannot drink. So it's, I feel like, you know, as I go away from Ramadan, my self-control sort of slips away, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I love chocolate, for instance.
Okay.
I cannot resist chocolate. I'll eat an entire chocolate bar every night, you know. But Ramadan reminds me that self-control.
Mm-hmm.
So we should be in control of ourselves at all times. Mm-hmm. And that's the strength it gives me.
Mm-hmm.
So the first couple of days are tough, but then after that we get used to it.
Yeah.
And then there's this inner strength that comes out, you know,
mm-hmm.
That helps us through the process.
Yeah. So where are you at in the month?
So we started, the first was May 6th.
Okay.
So we are like almost week and a half now.
Okay.
All yeah.
Right.
Yeah, actually week and a half. Yeah.
So
10 days
between, yeah. So you will break the fast during the night hours.
Yes, 8:38 tonight I can eat and drink, and mm-hmm. then we still continue to do the five prayers a day, and then we add on another prayer late at night.
Mm-hmm.
After we break our fast, we pray Maghrib, but then along with Isha, the late night prayer, we have a long prayer where we recite the Quran every night,
mm-hmm.
And we recite the entire Quran in that month.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
We get together at the mosque and pray that. It's called the Taraweeh.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for sharing all of that. Our colleague, Susanna Palaya Woodward, recently shared an article that was written about when final exams correspond
yes.
with Ramadan,
yes,
how we can be
tough.
More supportive of students. Like, how can we shift what that looks like?
I know one of my colleagues was talking about that. She mentioned, Dr. Knight, she was saying that in Europe, they usually have the exams at nighttime mm-hmm. for the students so
wow.
they can perform better.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's somebody in D.C. who's been doing that, and they're trying to pass that as a law or something, mm-hmm. that it is allowed or there's something going on about that I
sure.
heard in the news.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Could you envision anything like that at UMD?
I'm not sure at this point
yeah.
because there's not enough Muslims, and the ones that are here are afraid to say we are Muslims.
Okay.
Honestly, I'm even afraid to go to the mosque. Recently, the mosque was vandalized. And so,
it was.
Yeah, so we are even afraid to go to the mosque because, you know, because of all the things that are happening around.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
It's I didn't see that in the news. Was that in the news? The vandalism?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So where are you gathering? Well, I mean, clearly don't say on the air where you're gathering, but at an alternative, are you having to go elsewhere? Or?
It's just that the attendance at the mosque has gone down.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
One of my friends, Dr. Alexis Elder, immediately offered her husband's services to come and install some cameras.
Mm.
They're such wonderful people,
yeah.
you know, in the
yeah.
community. That,
sure.
So he's going to be installing a camera tomorrow.
Okay. Like a security type?
Security,
yeah.
right.
Okay.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
right. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. That's... hard to hear in our community. I mean, we hear about it in the news and out there, of course it's here also.
Yeah,
but the impact on you and our students and our colleagues.
Yeah, yeah. I worry about my husband and my son going to the mosque on Fridays. You know, mm-hmm. that's the fear.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. So maybe you've already answered this, but one of the questions that I like to ask everyone is it's more than that story, whether it's on a personal level or professional.
It's a lot more than that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm not just a professor. I'm a mother.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a wife. I'm a Muslim in Duluth community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a mentor to my students. I'm an advisor to my students. I'm a mentor to some of the junior faculty. I'm a colleague to my department colleagues
mm-hmm.
and other faculty and staff at UMD. I'm a Muslim. I'm a, U.S. citizen.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more to my story.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of responsibilities, but I enjoy every one of them.
Yeah.
I cherish every one of them.
Yeah. You lead a full life. I'm trying to not to use the word busy.
Thank you.
I'm replacing it with full because busy has such a negative connotation.
I agree. So, it's sort of scary, right?
Yeah, yeah. Busy feels mindless to me, and full can be more intentional and mindful, and it doesn't have to be chaotic and bad. It's just full.
Right.
So you lead a full life. I don't know if it feels busy at times, but...
It does get hectic, but I do enjoy those times.
Yeah.
Because all along I'm also publishing, I'm writing grants constantly, mm-hmm. one grant after another I'm writing. So there's something going on nonstop.
Right. So summer, I think there's this idea that faculty are off in the summer, and you just talked about this lab with 9 students being in every day in the summer.
Yes. And I have told them we are going to be in the lab 9 to 4 every day. We'll go out for lunch for an hour.
Wow.
And we'll all be there.
So
the first day, which was right after the exams week, that mm-hmm. Monday,
mm-hmm.
we all met and I gave them a nice pep talk.
mm-hmm.
And then we put down all the projects. We have about 10 to 12 projects we have to accomplish this summer.
Okay.
I have about 4 grants I have to write this summer, 7 papers. Lots of IRBs that are going through.
Mm-hmm.
There's one, the music study data collection that's happening right now.
Okay. For the listening audience, IRB is Institutional Review
Board
to get human permission to use human subjects.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is pretty intense.
Yeah.
It's not so easy to get through that process.
Right. Right.
So every project requires an IRB for me.
Yeah. Especially when you're working with, quote, vulnerable populations.
Exactly.
And I would imagine dementia patients would be a huge red flag for IRB in terms of...
It is. It is.
Ethical.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's pretty intense. Mm-hmm. So all my grad students are trained to do IRBs.
Okay.
For the undergrads, I write the IRBs.
Okay. So it's their projects.
Yes.
And you're advising and supervising. And...
Yeah. I come up with the ideas and I tell them and I guide them.
Okay.
And they do the coding and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
If they're stuck, I help them.
Okay. And then the papers are co-authored?
Co-authored, yes.
So
every paper, I have students working on it.
Wow.
Even if they give me data, they helped out with data, I put their names on it.
Wow.
Because I'm hoping I'm developing a drive in them to go to grad school.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them are. One of my students, Yumna Anwar, she got into a PhD program at University of Iowa, fully funded.
Wow. Congratulations.
Yeah, so every one of them is seeking to go to grad school.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And what an advantage to them to have that research experience, publications.
Yes.
I mean, that really gives them a leg up. So
right. I don't just assign the task and disappear, and yeah. they're working with them.
Yeah. yeah.
So they like that.
Yeah.
That I'm in the lab with them all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So only on the days that I'm teaching, I'll be in my office. Otherwise, I'm in the lab.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Did you have that, Arshia? Did you have a faculty or mentor like that?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I didn't. So that's why I want to give that to my students.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
wish I did.
Yeah. So, but you must have known that was a model or I mean, oftentimes we kind of replicate what happened for us.
Yeah, no, so. That unfortunately that didn't happen to me. I was sort of self-driven.
Yeah, okay.
So, but when I see a little bit of talent in a student, I try to encourage them to work with me, and mm-hmm. then usually they do, and then, you know, they enjoy research so much that they want to do it themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Good.
And my lab is a lot of fun. We have so many wearable sensors and robots, and so they love it.
Mm-hmm. Could I come visit sometime?
Absolutely, I would love
it. I would be fascinated to yes. to see that and feel like I'm entering into the future. But here it is now.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. We'll have to set that up. Yeah.
Yeah, I would love that.
A question that's mm-hmm. Coming up for me is, again, just around this idea of campus climate and mm-hmm. and religious tolerance. I don't like the word tolerance, but how, you know, are there ideas or thoughts you have on ways that we could create change on campus or in the community?
I think bringing awareness of diversity is critical.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, because people are afraid of what they don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And especially on the news, you know, the news likes to sort of show, you know, extreme cases.
Mm-hmm.
And for instance, if I were to go and do something disastrous, they would definitely put me on.
Right.
But if I give a talk on peace, it won't be on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think somehow showing the other side. If people know the unknown,
mm-hmm.
you know, they'll be more comfortable. Because after all, we are human beings and, you know, bottom line, we want to live in peace.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want chaos, or we do not want to fight constantly. We want to be living in peace.
Mm-hmm.
And because they're afraid of the unknown, they think that they need to fight us. And somehow if we can bring that awareness, you know, and so I take myself as a walking model,
mm-hmm.
you know, so at some point, openly, I will say I'm a Muslim to all my students.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at that point, I will not be afraid that, you know, my student evaluations will be impacted or something like mm-hmm. that. And hopefully then they will realize, oh, we never thought she was a Muslim, you know. And
mm-hmm. and as you said, you don't fit that stereotype. So that's exactly. a way to break down the stereotypes is, I mean, even your research and your work and the media that you've gotten
exactly.
and associating that with Muslim as opposed to what the media usually associates.
Exactly.
I think is a strategy for change, definitely.
Absolutely.
Yeah. yeah.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So and we could do more on campus to lift each other up. And as you say, that tension between folks not wanting to be out
yes.
of their Muslim closets.
Yes.
I think that's a fine line that we need to walk. And
exactly, because they're afraid of the consequences
right.
and what might happen.
Yeah.
And, so which is understandable. And then I can understand the other side also, people being afraid of Muslims, you know.
Understand it in
the sense that, you know, if like say if I were to watch a particular news channel that is very anti-Muslim, mm-hmm. I do not want to name anybody.
Yeah, okay.
You know, there was a friend of mine who once said, oh, I've been watching this channel because that's the only channel I'm getting on my television, and I'm starting to hate myself.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Because repeatedly, if you keep hearing negative things, you know, it's like, for instance, Ramadan is such a beautiful thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like purifying your mind, body, your soul. It's so much more. If that message could be sent out, you know, that Muslims are supposed to practice being excellent human beings. You know, we cannot lie, we cannot hurt anybody, we cannot do anything bad at this time, you know. It's that practice. So there's such beauty to this, you know. If people could know about these kind of things about Islam, that would be wonderful.
Right, yeah. And to have violence imposed, you know, on you, particularly during that time, is just such a such a trauma, increased trauma. Well, thank you for sharing yourself and your stories, and
thank you for inviting me,
helping to shift some of that narrative out there. I really do believe that that you putting yourself out there is part of it. So I hope it's a positive impact and not a negative.
Yeah. One time I went for a dinner with some of my friends at a conference, and they were all drinking alcohol and I did not drink. And so one of the females in that group turned towards me and said, "Why aren't you drinking? You know, we are walking back to the hotel. You will not have a problem." And I said, "Because I'm a Muslim." But then immediately I told her, "I don't tell people that I'm a Muslim. It's just between us." And she said, "No, you should tell people because you don't look like a Muslim. You will actually be helping the Muslims by telling that you're a Muslim." You'll be breaking that stereotype, is what she said.
Yeah. So how did that land for you?
Yeah, it was really good to hear that from her because she didn't think I was a Muslim and she had a different image of a Muslim. She said, "I would never have guessed that you're a Muslim." So it was good to hear. I think it was sort of encouraging for me to say that, okay, I'm a Muslim. I should be able to feel comfortable saying that.
It is
very tough. It hasn't been easy to raise kids here, you know, especially in Duluth because there's such a small Muslim community. And we are far from our family and friends, so, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, the community here is our friend, but it has been difficult. So we try to sort of, you know, serve by example for our kids. Yeah. And we try to keep telling them, you know, like my son, when he was in elementary school, his friends called him a terrorist. And so he came back and he asked me, you know. So they question it.
Sure.
And which is good. They should.
Yeah.
They should. And then it's our job to educate them and tell them, inform them about it. So.
And the school. I mean, did the school have a response that was helpful to your family?
We did not report to the school.
Okay.
Yeah. We didn't. We didn't know what to do, you know. We didn't want to make a fuss about it. And we think that, you know, if you let it slide, it's better than making a big deal out of it.
Okay. Did it continue into middle school and high school?
No, but I think my daughter also, 2 years ago, she was called a terrorist. So it continues with different kids.
Sure.
Yeah. Again, that's because of ignorance.
Right.
Yeah. But it does have an impact on my kids because they come back and they are sort of down for a few days.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, and it's at times they don't tell me, at times they share it with me. Because they don't want to keep hearing the same thing from me again and again, you know, and I sound like a broken record, you know.
In terms of your reassuring them.
So they don't want to hear that again, so they don't share. And they don't even at times have the courage to tell us that. So, but all in all, you know, they love their friends. They've got good friends, and they're doing well at school. And So overall, it's good. It's like just once in a while, these small things that happen, you know.
Yeah. And the small things add up. I mean, we know that.
They do.
Yeah, they do.
Like one of the incidents that happened to us that I worry about might have impacted my kids is we were driving into our house. At that time, there was construction going on across our house on that street. And there was a state trooper who followed us. So this was late at night, 11 o'clock in the night, because we were coming from Hayward. My husband was post-call. So I was driving and he was in the passenger seat. And we were just about to turn into the house and the state trooper stopped us. And we stopped and the way I was like, because I was turning, I was sort of perpendicular on the road. So I wanted to get parallel, you know, because I was afraid somebody would hit me. So he took his mic out and he yelled at me saying, "I told you to stop. You stopped this second." So I got scared and I stopped. And then he came up and he took my driver's license and he asked me where I was going. And I said, "I'm going into my house right across." And he couldn't believe I lived there. And then he took my husband's driver's license and he called the Border Patrol on us. And so my kids were little at that time. So it was three kids, my mom and my dogs. Two dogs in the car,
in the van. Wow.
And so he kept us there for 40 minutes till the Border Patrol showed up. So, and then the Border Patrol checked on us and they just said, "They're American citizens, let them go."
And that was a long time ago because your kids are older now.
They're older now.
Yeah.
But I worry, will they trust the police now?
Right, right, right. Yeah. And should they?
Should they? Well,
yeah.
I hope they should. Can
but I mean that's that can be a story that we hear. I've it's an increasing story, I believe, for people of color. People who don't, who might appear to look like they don't belong here.
Right.
Yeah.
And
which is a narrative.
Right. When we wrote a letter to the State Department, the explanation was he saw foreign nationals in the car, and he thought we were terrorists. So that was difficult to digest.
And that was, that excuse was good enough. I mean, that was the explanation. So that's the end of it?
Yeah, that was the end of it.
Yeah. Which shouldn't be the end of it. Because that's everything we've talked about, the stereotypes and and the negative labels that are being perpetuated with that level of power is, I think, a big part of the problem that we're having in this country right now at UMD. And so,
when we get into situations like that, we have to think with a cool mind that, you know, okay, I'm fasting. I have already fasted for so many hours. Do I want to ruin all those or do I want to get back at this person?
So even that discipline in that moment of injustice becomes a helpful strategy.
Yes.
I would imagine.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
And actually when the cop, the state trooper stopped us, we were just afraid, you know. Because my husband was asking him, you know, why are you expecting the, you can see our address on the driver's license. We are not lying to you. And he shouldn't have even asked for my husband's driver's license. But he got suspicious because of his last name. His last name is Muhammad. So at that time, we were just afraid, just don't shoot us, you know.
Right. Oh, especially yelling for you to, I mean, there was an escalation that was happening that can get out of control. Was there anything that you would like to make sure is part of this podcast that you'd like to share that hasn't come up or I haven't asked you about?
I just want to make sure that, you know, the message out there is that yes, we do face these kind of things. But overall, you know, there's so many good people like you. You know, there's wonderful people who are there to support. You know, when 9/11 happened at that time, my neighbors, they came out and they were like, we will wear the headscarf and go with you out. There were friends who showed up saying, I'll take you out grocery shopping.
Yeah.
So there are wonderful people. You know, it's a small group of people who don't understand us. And I seriously hope that the media rethinks this by showing Muslims as evil and bad. You know, they're doing disservice to the community,
right,
to all humans. It's not benefiting anybody. You know, show the truth. Don't just keep showing, you know, there's a bunch of bad people in every faith. And I agree, some of the Muslims do horrible things. They should not be doing those things. That's un-Islamic. But don't just show those things. There are a lot of Muslims who do wonderful things. So if they can show those kind of things, you know, put a decent face to a Muslim's name. Oftentimes, you know, if a Muslim does something bad, immediately it's associated with Islam. Anybody else does it, there's no mention of the faith.
Right.
Why drag the faith into it?
Yeah.
Why are Muslims always attached to their faith, you know? It's like this big ball that's you're dragging all around the world, you know?
And as you mentioned, it's more than that. You are so much more than that. You are that, and you are so much more than that. And a very positive face of good in this world, in this community. And we are so lucky and grateful to have you at UMD in the Duluth community. And I just thank you so much for sharing all of you.
Thank you. Us. This move to UMD has been wonderful for me. I love it here.
Good.
And I'm in heaven.
Yay.
Yeah.
I'm glad.
Yeah. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah. Oh, my parting gift. Hopefully when you have moments of breaking your fast here, I brought you some eggs. Do you eat eggs?
Yes, I love eggs.
These are special eggs from our
farm. From your chickens?
From our chickens.
Oh my God, thank you so much.
You're welcome. And
thank you,
happy, like, free-ranging, eating the ground.
Oh, nice.
So they're...
How many chickens do you have?
Too many. We have 21 now. They keep reproducing.
Oh, wow. Aren't the chicks the cutest thing on the planet?
They really are. That's why we keep allowing it to happen. And then we end up with more and more.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So I'm happy to share a personal gift and part of our lives. I know you know Sarah well, too.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, yes.
Pleasure.
Oh, Sarah is such a sweetheart.
Yeah, she is. She is. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. You guys do such wonderful things in the community, you know.
Thank you.
We are very, very grateful to both of you, you and Sarah.
Thank you. You can listen to more episodes of UMD's It's More Than That podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Visit d.umn.edu/campusclimate to find additional information on our episodes and more about what the University of Minnesota Duluth is doing to build a better, more welcoming campus community for all. And you can sign our pledge and work with us on your own personal journey.